Welcome to Ever Beyond.
Broadcast through the Wolf Spirit Media Network.
Be prepared to leave your belief systems behind as we go beyond teachers, beyond gurus, beyond duality, ever beyond.
Please join us in the chat room at www.wolfspiritradio.com/listen. You're listening to Wolf Spirit Radio.
Wolf Spirit Radio, you are listening to indeed, and now I can hear it. Yes, it's in my headphones. Good. That's very good. Welcome, welcome, welcome. It is the 12th of March, 2017. And, oh, it's not a 17. There's no 7. And it's like, I've done so many shows recently. Oh, it's the 17th of the 7th and the 7th, 7th, and all this 7 business. So, it's good. We like 12. 12's are good as well. It's the next step up. So, 12th of March, it's, oh wow, it's the week of the Ides. Beware the Ides of March. Yes, indeed, the 15th. And indeed, 1500 PST it is. All right, so Pacific Daylight Time. I am so knackered. I am so exhausted. I am so tired, people. Because daylight, I forgot that daylight's even shifted, so everything starts an hour earlier, and so I'm pottering around, lazily. Oh my god, it's 6 o'clock. Oh my god, it's 11, but actually, neither of my two previous hosts also remembered that it was the daylight saving change time, so even they weren't prepared. So it's been a day. However, here in the U of K, we are highly prepared. Our daylight doesn't change for another 2 weeks. And so, without any further ado, let's get on with the shoe. Let's get on with the shoe. That didn't quite rhyme. Anyway, tonight my guest is, returning friend and guest, Wynne Keach. And, I thought, well, actually I had some kind of, I'm so tired I can't remember why I asked you on. But we got lots to talk about. There's loads of stuff that's been going on. Since we last spoke, we've both had insights and memories, stuff coming back from the very, very distant past, long back in the day, long before the little dream harp can take us. Well, we'll try using the dream harp. We'll need to stretch the time machine a bit, in its capabilities, because we're gonna have to go back a long way. However, welcome. Wynne Keach, how are you, my friend?
I'm very fine, JP. And yes, the reason I'm here to talk is about barter exchange or fair exchange systems and the history of money and where the world's going this year, really, and why we need all that sort of thing very quickly.
Well, from what we, what we've been seeing, this week, this very week is signaled as some kind of moment in the history of money and the kind of final moments of the history of money, when the great bankers themselves, the total and complete bankers, pull their plugs out and drains the whatever fluidity, liquidity is left in the system, having already drained most of it out anyway. So this is a very salient, opportune moment to bring in something that is alternative, or at least get our eyes focused off of this stupid money system and onto something that is a little more sustainable. So, all right, that's about my words up, used up for the month. Over to you, Wynne.
Yes, that's some very good words, thank you. Yes, I've got my sensible hat on today, and as we know on previous shows that I've done with the JP, I've had past life experiences and some very interesting experiences in this life that are definitely out there compared to most people's understanding of reality. But if we go back to my earlier life when I was very sensible, and this is going back a long way now. This is half a lifetime ago. Some people may have noticed. It became quite plain when people started to jump up and down about me filming the 777 crop circle, for instance. People suddenly said, well, who's he and what's his credibility? And then they were shocked to find that my credibility is I'm the man that developed all the PIN processes on your credit and debit cards. So you trust me every day, even though you don't know it. And that was my history. 15 years of my life, I was a world leader in computer authentication and PIN processes on acquiring networks for credit and debit cards. So very tedious, very involved, very hard work. That was 7 days a week, 14 hours a day for 15 years of my life, which eventually led me, as you know, to go into renewable energy. When I finished doing that, I went off and invented the world's best micro wind turbine and went off-grid, live in my house, which is off-grid, its own water, its own electricity, its own everything except this phone line. So I can't vouch for the phone line, but I can vouch for the rest of my off-gridness here. And this brought me 2 years ago to dusting off the annals of PIN and computer authentication history and picking up where I left off, and specifically for an authentication process and a processing platform for an alternative way of trading. And this is a hybrid system of what people would understand as a normal e-trading system, you know, e-payments, e-trading, and what would was traditionally known as barter, although it's not a word we like to use, because barter is actually a 14th century word, which means to have sexual intercourse. So an alternative values exchange. And this led to the formation of Fairex, which is the name of the company, and it is also the name of the system, and it's sort of an abbreviation for Fair Exchange, because I believe very strongly, both in community, and that people should have control over their own wealth and their own money, and that there should be a fair exchange for trade rather than the present debt leverage system that's out there now, which is really nothing more than a massive Ponzi pyramid scheme, which, as we'll see very soon, will start resetting its value this year, and it's going to upset a lot of people. And if you haven't anywhere else to go, really, you need Fairex, because most normal people can't afford $23,000 for a bar of gold. And if you did have one, somebody would probably murder you for it or break into your house and steal it. And there needs to be a way of trading. And we can go back through history, go through the history of money and how it all came about and how debt-leveraged fractional reserve systems came into being. The fact that debt money was actually originated from Babylonia. It was a Babylonian system. It was brought to you by the same people that brought slavery. And they view you pretty much as a chattel, or cattle, as the old French word. It's one and the same. And, yeah, so here we are. So we're at an interesting time. You know, we've got Mr. Trump there taking all the flak and draining the swamp. We've got a big section of the planet waking up and suddenly looking back and thinking, well, what's happened for the last thousands of years? Why are we where we are and how can we make it better? And so politics are getting shaken up. I think religion will soon be under similar pressures. And the one remaining control factor is money. And the good people that I work with, we've all got together and we are bringing you Fairex. So this is quite unique in that it's not only an alternative values trading system, but it's ideal for everything from normal everyday trading and maximizing your cash liquidity. So you can have small amounts of cash and be able to trade for much larger values by direct exchange of goods, for instance, which if you live in India right now, you would absolutely kill for. And I think we're going to see a lot more of this of the planet as they try and demonetize the planet. We're also going to see banking instability, specifically in the US and in Europe. Europe specifically is going to be having a rough time this year. It's going to probably fragment, and so will its banking system and its monetary systems. And these are going to upset the traditional gamblers on the stock markets and that sort of thing, and going to lead to the banks all sitting on their hands and not lending people very much money. So cash liquidity is likely to be quite tight by this time in sort of 6 months' time. which will affect things like your jobs and your ability to earn money and the value of your house and the housing markets and that sort of thing. So we're coming over the hill with Fairex, and we're coming in very quickly, and there will be lots of people out there who aren't on the good side who will be absolutely bricking it tonight when they hear what we've been doing. Because, as Napoleon said, there is no standing army that can stand in the way of an idea whose time has come. And that's what Fairex is.
I want some fanfares. I haven't got any. Oh, well. So, yes, Fairex, obviously fair exchange. Didn't know that about barter.
You see, I have to know everything.
You have to.
I'm a system architect and engineer.
It's important to know the meaning of every single word. Barter. So, how can I now say I really enjoy barter?
Yes,
I do like a barter
century,
system.
Yeah, 14th century meant we'd nip behind the bike sheds and get busy. And so, yes, it's interesting how words change. So I guess on.
Well, you know, there's a funny thing that we have about the 15th century here. We got a, there's a soul group who, involved in one of the shows, that all knew each other in the 15th century. So, it's interesting. So, there was probably a bit of bartering going on there even in the 15th.
A bit of bartering indeed.
Yeah.
Barter as a world system is actually quite well established, but it tends to be business to business and large corporate to large corporate. Which the difference between, everything that's out there and what I'm doing is that Fairex, allows trades between any scale. So, although it's primarily targeted at people, the man in the street, you and me, and small businesses, SMEs, small medium enterprises, because actually most of the work is done by people and small medium enterprises. Both sides of the Atlantic, the US and the UK, 99% of all businesses are in fact SMEs. And of those, 45% when surveyed would barter trade if they could. So at the moment, for instance, global barter trade is around $15.9 trillion dollars per annum. So that's roughly 23% of world trade is actually carried out in the form of barter. But that's largely large corporate to large corporate. So I will sell you this batch of cars in exchange for some materials and et cetera, et cetera. But some nations have obviously seized this both hands and run with it. South America, for instance, is very up on barter. A large percentage of trade, for instance, in Brazil, which is a very strong economy. Although it's had a recession for 2 or 3 years, it's forecast to come out of its recession this year. But a major part of agro-economy there is carried out by barter because of the trading condition in the 1990s where they had to turn to it. And it turns out to be more efficient. Similarly, countries like Venezuela, which have had devastating economic crisis with the collapse of oil prices in the last few years, the most materials that the man in the street gets, he has to get by barter. So in Venezuela, there are 2,500 Facebook sites where people are trading nappies for toilet rolls and trading old pharmaceuticals for parts for your car and that sort of thing. But it's the only way you can get anything because there's no cash for buying imports. So people have to buy what's out there and recycle what's out there as effectively as they can that people already own. And that's the beauty of barter. And the other beauty of barter is that something that you trade in barter is usually worth almost exactly the same. So no matter what happens to the external economy, the absolute value of something stays relatively fixed. Hence, we have an electronic currency within the Fairex system, which anchors itself to the commodity price of everything on the planet. That's quite unique. So that you have effectively an ultra-low inflation currency. So that no matter what happens to the outside fluctuations in currency, the value of everything you trade within the system is always relatively the same. It's only varied by local supply and demand constraints. And the system monitors local prices and provides pricing suggestions and sets the overall value of the currency based on the value of everything that's traded, which ultimately will be a percentage of everything that's in the world. So that means that, for instance, if you'd taken your dollar and you'd put it into my system, not only the other unique factor about the system is that it's 100% capitalized. So you put your dollar in and you want to take your dollar back out, you always get your dollar back out, no matter what happens. The only thing that could stop you getting your dollar back out is if there is nowhere for it to go, i.e. there is no bank to receive it. So that's not a problem, because internally Fairex will carry on just as before, and you can still trade just as you did before, and that's the whole point of it. It's both a hybrid system to the existing banking systems and infrastructure that's out there, which helps generate more wealth for people and more wealth for nations to operate it. But also, it is a lifeboat in case something catastrophic goes wrong and there is, you know, countrywide or even global banking problems. Fairex can carry on without a heartbeat. It's like an uninterruptible power supply for a computer. It's the same thing for economy. So that's rather good. So it means that if you put your dollar in, it's always worth whatever a dollar can buy at the time you put it in.
UPS for the economy, I like that.
As a UPS for the economy, indeed it is. And it's also empowering. So it's your own power. Just like as you know, I've done decades work on cutting edge work on renewable energy. So for instance, if you have a UPS system, imagine if that was running your house, for instance, you had a large UPS that was running your house. And you have the mains coming in. So you have the dirty old mains, you know, from burning dinosaurs and what have you. And you have some renewable energy on your roof. So you have some wind, you have some solar generation, and you can feed that into your UPS. And of course, if you then switch off the external mains, then you're still running on the renewable energy. So if you've got enough renewable energy there, then you carry on as before and you don't need the old dirty mains anymore. It's the same. So you could be running on good, renewable, clean energy instead of dirty energy. You have the option. But you can always throw the switch and run off the mains if it's cheaper or more convenient or you just want to do it. So you have more options, and Fairex is about giving people options and giving the economy options. But most of all, it's about empowering people to have control over their own wealth and money. So quite uniquely, and this is why I'm doing it, because I'm probably the only person in the world other than Simon Parks that would do this, is that I am here to set this up, to run it for everyone who is a customer to operate it, and to operate it on behalf of everybody else. So effectively everybody that is a user of it will be effectively a part owner and a part collaborator on the system. So it becomes a distributive system. It is everybody that uses it. It's quite simply, who do you trust most of your money? And the answer is you. And I'm simply there as somebody to shepherd it, to guard it for them, and use my expertise in authentication security and processing transaction security to make sure that it is safe, efficient, and that basically only the people that are going to trade in ethical and moral ways can use the system. Because as a community, we can all vote to say, no, we don't want that guy in there because he's dealing drugs, or we don't want that guy in there because he's trading in prostitution or something that's antisocial. Then we can exclude these people, because to be in this system is a privilege, because it allows you more efficient use of the cash you have, and it allows you to generate much more wealth for yourself than you could outside of the system. So it's an entire new ethos as well as a new system. And hopefully it will show the world the way it can be done. And it will be basically the rocket that gives us the escape velocity to drag our way away from the Babylonian money system in terms of our control over our own destiny and our own wealth.
Our destiny and our wealth. Well, that's what we want. I could do with a bit of destiny, and we can all use more money. Just a little request of the universe. I can use more money, and there it comes. So, looking at a barter system that kind of dovetails, smoothly takes over, people are going to always say, oh, I want real money. And they think that, you know, their dollar in their pocket or the pound in their pocket is what they call real money. But it's all an agreement. The whole idea of money. I mean, you know, everybody knows the story of money these days. I mean, it's particularly the Wall Street Radio listeners. So we're not going to bore you with why money is bad or what the hell's wrong with it. But people are, what's the word? Not latency. Reluctant. That's the word. There is a reluctancy to step away, even though people know it's a bad thing. There's a reluctancy to step away. Reluctance. Yeah, to step away from it. Sorry, I'm just phrasing myself as a minute. There's a reluctance to step away from, that which you know into something that which you don't know. I mean, we had enough trouble, shifting from pound, shillings and pence to decimal currency. And they ripped us off, which is why we were a bit, you know, wary in the first place. So, I think that's probably, again, one of the reasons that people are wary to move, because always there's going to be sharks. Where there's muck, there's brass, and where there's brass, there's mafia. How do we eliminate the racketeering and extortion and, you know, most of all, violence? Because that's what money is really based on. It's based on the potential of violence against your person.
Well, it's interesting. It's about 5 questions there, but I'll start at the beginning.
I know. I'm kind of stacking you up there. I thought I'll just go and make some tea while you know.
I thought as much. Yes, the thing with money is money's rather like smoking cigarettes in the 1950s. People then didn't know how bad it was for them. And then as we moved into the sort of 1990s, people became aware that it was actually killing them. And that's what money's doing at the moment, because it's killing people and it's killing the planet. And it's killing all the sparks of goodness on the planet, because it's carrying with it a negative energy, and it's stimulating the percentage of society, which is actually quite a small percentage, that suffer from sociopathic and psychopathic disorders, basically, or outlooks. So it favours the mentally unbalanced, really. Yeah, is the only way I can put it.
The nutters in our society.
Yes, well, if you look at the structure of society and how the capital system works, and I bring in this my general experience, and I've travelled the world and I've worked all over the world, and there are only 2 sort of types of people in the world. There are good people and bad people. That's all there are. And there are far more good people than there are bad people. But the bad people tend to cause a real mess of things, and they have their hands on levers with things like money, and that's when the problem starts to escalate, because then it amplifies their damage, basically. And so it becomes then basically global. It becomes community-wide. So, yes, so money has basically been a bit like cigarettes. It's bad for you. Everybody knows it's bad for you, but people are addicted to it, and they don't see an alternative. But this is a bit like those e-cigarettes now. So you can have the experience, but without the damaging side to it. So this is kind of the transition that we're on now. And since we have all this global infrastructure now of mobile phone technology, internet technology, and huge percentage of the population is now connected to the rest of the planet, we now have the ability to do these things. But the way to do this is not to say, oh, let's all move to a completely new system. The way to do it is to run it as a hybrid, so that you run them in parallel. So yeah, you can smoke your cigarettes if you want, but if you gave up smoking a few cigarettes and did something else with that cash and that experience, then you can actually compensate for some of the damage of the other side. And eventually, if you wanted to give up completely, then yes, you could just move to your e-cigarettes. It's entirely up to you. But for people who find it difficult to move, do both and use each system to its best advantage. So you may have comfort in the old system in that it's what you know and you've always done it. So despite all its problems, it's what you've grown up with. And then the new system, well, yes, as you get used to it and start to find its advantages over the old in terms of it's able to connect you to community and to create networks of integrity, and able to communicate and trade in ways you never could before, which enables you to create more wealth, use your time better, make more money from surplus time, commodities, efforts, enables charities to collect efforts and materials and even contributions directly to enable communities to form direct action charities and then have the resource targeted to them, enable renewable energy installations all over the planet, enable people to build affordable homes, all the sort of things you want. This can do, because ultimately the only thing that's ever been stopping you doing this is finance and money. And they're two separate things. The problem is that the large corporates and your governments and your central banks all control finance, and you don't. You don't control it. You're on the receiving end of it. So you're on the receiving end of the taxation and the debt-issued money and the interest on money you have to borrow to finance your mortgage or finance your car or finance anything you need to do that's beyond your immediate capacity to create yourself. But if you're able to network with people that have access to other resources and other capabilities, and you can trade them directly, first of all, you strip away the taxation and you strip away the debt burden that's on the money that you're trading with. So you're immediately trading in a more efficient manner, and you're also creating opportunities that you didn't know were there because you weren't able to network in a trade environment. And Fairex is all about that. It's about identifying opportunities, and it's about creating integrity nodes that strengthen trust between micro communities all over the globe. Does that answer your question?
Yep. So, hybridization is a good way of infiltrating into a system.
Yes, there's no sudden shock to the system.
Yeah. It's interesting, you know, hybrid, because we all always talk about reptilian hybridization, you see. Very good.
Yes, well, it's judo in that case, or jujitsu. We're throwing the energy back, and money actually is energy. It was explained to me by my wonderful friend and fantastic musician David Moss and Masha Kaysner. They explained to me some years ago, because I'd never actually liked money, which is another good reason why I'm in control of this system, because I don't actually like the stuff. But they explained that actually you need money to operate in this world, and it is a form of energy. And then when you start looking at it and you look at the history of money, you realize that actually it's quite dark energy, and you need an alternative. So you need an alternative framework to be able to trade, but you also need to trade it in a way that provides good energy and to that monetary system, so that it is a social system as well as a monetary system, and that's exactly what Fairex is.
Well, this is a very interesting point, though, which I've just completely lost. As you're saying, that you like the, you know, those who like money shouldn't be allowed to mess with it, you know.
Absolutely.
Shouldn't be allowed to trade with it. I kind of, you know, I really understand that, because I've always found it's the holding things in preciousness that causes problems. Just look at the Lord of the Rings. It's one of our human conditions, and it's probably got a long history. Maybe we'll go to that later, but. Being able to trade using a universal exchange system.
Yep.
Now, here's the thing. The problem. All right. So yeah, that's where I was getting to. The problem with money is it's made of blood. It's as I said before. It's based on violence. It's based
slavery.
On you will be. You'll accept these rules or we'll beat the crap out of you. And as Sean says, we got a whole bunch of other people who agree with me and we'll continue to beat the snot out of you.
Yes, and I'll issue an IOU that says I promise to pay the bearer, but you try and get it off me. You try knocking on the door of the palace and saying, excuse me, could I have my pound of sterling, please, or my pound of gold? I don't think that's going to happen, do you?
Wouldn't it be nice to have a pound of sterling these days? I've never had it, but I only learned about it recently, is that you can be paid in golden guineas, like the posh knobs in Britain, when they do a job for people, they say, you know, pay me in golden guineas, which would be a very nice wage for a job, I have to say. Golden guinea was about a quarter ounce of gold, I think, something like that.
Yes, yes, but the trouble with gold is you can't eat it. And as the Russians say, if you could eat money, nobody in the world would starve.
Exactly.
However, if you have a currency system based on commodity, then you can, because if your e-currency dollar or pound equivalent is equivalent to a bag of potatoes or two dozen eggs or three loaves of bread, then that's exactly what it is. So you can eat that money because it's directly exchangeable for it. And in the barter system, yes, you can swap your eggs for your carrots or whatever, and you don't have to carry lumps of gold around.
You know, this is very interesting, and it takes us back to the kind of previous little vignette you were talking about, in that what money is, if you know what money is, then you have the right attitude towards it. And for me, the right attitude towards it is that it's just exactly the same as a bag of coal, as you say, a bag of carrots, a pint of petrol, or gasoline. It's a stock of fuel. And that's really all we need, is we need fuel. You know, I need, I need cups of tea, you know, stuff like that. You know, you need fuel to make tea, and you need fuel, you know, tea is also fuel. And, you know, we have eggs and all, you know, our exchangeable commodities for fuel. This is the ultimate of any, money system, is can you stay alive using that system? I've been trying to work our local barter system to do exactly that. I've lived incredibly, I don't want to say cheaply over the last 10-20 years.
Efficiently,
yeah. On, you know, a very low energy, you know, I'm like the equivalent of a low energy light bulb in terms of how much energy I try to sip off the system. You know, just take a little sip at a time rather than taking great gallons and drafts of electricity.
Yes, it's exactly the same as renewable energy. As soon as you go off grid, you suddenly start using your energy more efficiently because you're aware of what it takes to create it. And it's the same with money. If you had your own money system, you would use it more efficiently because you're aware of what it actually means. The biggest problem people on the planet have at the moment is people mostly aren't aware of what money really is, what its origins are, and they definitely don't understand global economics. Even the economists don't. I mean, to quote our Queen in 2008 when there was the very large crash then, when she went to a talk at the London School of Economics, her quote was, "Well, if you're so clever, why didn't you see this coming?" So it shows you that even the people who are supposed to model economy don't really understand it, because it's made to be an obfuscation. It's made to be sufficiently complex that the person in the street just isn't going to apply time and effort to understand it, because if they did, they probably wouldn't sleep at night. Are you still there, JP?
Yeah, I was in the kitchen.
Ah, I see, okay.
Trying to make a coffee to stay awake now.
It's talking about tea, I see.
Yeah. So there you go. So I'm listening because I've got speakers in the kitchen.
So I'm saying the economy the way the economy is actually structured is such that most people have no visibility of how it works on a global scale, and it's sufficient complexity that even people that study it in schools of economics don't understand it properly. And in fact, I studied as a control engineer, bizarrely enough, at university, and I think as a control engineer we probably modelled it better than most economists, because the people on my course are the people who went off to write the systems that operate the computers that manage economic systems. So we had to understand the dynamics of it.
Right. Okay, that's the question. That's where the question was, is, mm-hmm. Wynn, can you break... right, as you said, you know, you got it explained to you.
Mm-hmm.
Can you pass on that wisdom to our audience, that you know, what money is so that people are not scared of it or in awe of it or otherwise separated from the idea that we can create it just as much as any banker can.
Of course you can.
That's the question. So do you want to break it down for us and take it to the limit?
Absolutely. Yeah, we'll wind it back to basics. It's my job to understand these things and to try to explain.
So let's use the time machine.
Okay, going back.
Oh, I feel so 14th century.
Okay, well, let's go Roman. Okay, let's go back to the Roman Empire.
Even further.
Yes, indeed. Let's start there because...
Etu Brute, because it's the Ides of March, you know.
Indeed. Well, we'll go back to Roman times because this is a good example of how economies rise and fall and what drives that rising and falling. Now, interestingly, there's a social pressure and there's an economic pressure. And the actual fall of the Roman Empire wasn't a military collapse as such. It was actually an economic collapse, which allowed them to be overrun militarily because they couldn't afford the military. So if you go right back to the beginning of the Roman Empire, the differential in payment between Caesar, even, and the lowest paid person in their entire civilization was a factor of 10 to 1. So it doesn't matter if you were, you know, poverty stricken in the streets of the Roman Empire, you were still earning a tenth of the amount that Caesar was earning. However, as time went on and the empire expanded and it needed more finance to expand itself, it started cutting corners and basically deregulating its money. So you started off with trading in silver coins. And the Roman Empire was trading with China exclusively in gold at the time, and the Silk Route and all that kind of thing. Hence, the Chinese have a lot of gold as a result of that. But their silver currency, for instance, they started trimming corners off it so that they devalued physically the currency because the currency was the weight of the silver that they were trading. And then they started to devalue it even more, so they detached from the value of the weight of silver from the currency by making bronze coins, but that represented the previous value of the silver coin. And this carried on until it went through the same cycle that we're going through now in terms of it didn't bear any resemblance to any commodity at all. And it was in fact just debt issued money that was, just a promissory note effectively. It's just a promissory, value. And at that point, As happens, the social strata start to separate. So the 80% of us at the bottom that are all working and making everything and relatively earning less or no more than we were before, tend to march on. And the 20% above that are managing, controlling and otherwise manipulating the 80% beneath get richer and richer because they're now in control of the finance. And so the finance goes to the people that are in their club, which you're not in. And so their enterprises bloom because they have a disproportionate amount of finance available compared to the little guy on the street who's just selling whatever or making whatever. And then the relative ratio of the earnings gets disproportionate. And once it goes past a factor of about 100 to 1, then... sociologists show that that's when society starts to become unstable. And that's exactly what happened with the Roman Empire. When it went past 100 to 1 and it went way past that, then the actual wealth within the empire was diluted, but the finance was increased. And that's what we're seeing now. So the real wealth is detached from the finance debt wealth because it's just a amount of debt. It's mostly money that doesn't exist. I mean, I worked... for years in a bank processing system, and you realise that most money actually does not exist. It's just numbers on a computer. The physical money that's in the world, which is the only real money, is comparatively small. You know, it's less than 10%. And, you know, once you've gone past, the next level of capital, which are things like property, you still only have a small percentage of the world's wealth actually physically exists. The rest of it is just debt. And when you're the guy at the bottom that's paying for all this debt, because you're the guy's paying the taxes, you're the guy's paying all the debt on the money that's in circulation, then you become aggrieved when you can no longer feed your family because you're working all hours that there are and your currency is being devalued, so the prices have inflated, so its relative value is less because that's how the banks suck the real value out of assets. And you end up with this huge disparity, and then eventually people pick up their shovels and pitchforks and go and say it's them over there and then start to attack them, and then society collapses. And this is at the point we're at now. It's very close to it.
We definitely have that pitchforks and torches moment just coming up, just like this week, you know.
Yeah, it's coming up right now. I mean, we're in the eye of the storm now, and this week's going to be interesting, the week after even more interesting. As you see, we'll reach on the 15th the US debt ceiling. They're going to have to negotiate to raise their debt ceiling from $20 trillion by another trillion dollars just to fund the restructuring of industry in the United States alone. But since the previous agreement comes to the end on the 15th, if they don't agree, and since they will all be dancing around their hats and generally being self-centered and self-serving, then that will cause problems in itself, and that will undermine the trust that has been temporarily gleaned by Mr. Trump being inaugurated and put in place as president, and that will send a bit of a wobble. And then when people sit down and realise that the implications that they're going to calculate from the lack of trade between China and America as America tries to put up its barriers to generate its own industry at the expense of its trading partners, they will see there'll be a time lag in that, and so then they'll work out that in that case the market's gone about as high as it's going to go, and so we need to start taking the profit out now. And when they do that, then the market will start to slide as they extract the value from it, and people then start betting on the market going down, in which case it'll be artificially accelerated down. And then people will panic, and the interest rates will start going up, and the government will start be squeezed because it then has to raise taxes to pay the extra interest on the huge debt that it's already got, which it probably can't afford. And then you'll find that the banks will have a wobble because they're all paying swapping the debt amongst themselves, and when they stop playing pass the parcel, then they'll start counting what the actual liquidity it is they have in their own banks to lend. And since they only have to carry 10 pence in the pound or 10 cents in the dollar due to the fractional reserve rules, actually, when they start leveling out the debt mountain that they're in from the trades, because they've sucked all the value out of the working guy with the very dubious mortgage scam before 2008, and then they sucked all the value out of the middle class in the States when they had to stump up $1.3 trillion to bail out the banks that had stolen the money in the first place, and that then disrupted the sort of powerhouse of sort of innovation and strident development in the States. You know, 10% of what was previously the middle class in the United States now in a working class environment. So that's 3 million people that went from a good salary each year to half that salary, and so they can't be given the burden anymore to bail out any hiccups in the banking system. The government bonds have been trading quite low. The value's been sucked out of those since 2008. And so that's the only remaining area of being the foreign exchange for the currencies, and that's why you've seen currencies being targeted and wobbling up and down recently, because that's the last avenue of sucking real value out of the system. So once they've got to that peak, there is nowhere else for it to go except to reset somewhat. So part of the value that's been gained since Mr. Trump's been here will probably be lost. And people being so short-sighted and basically a very little foresight, it will cause some instability and some uncertainty, and that will probably result in the banks sitting on what cash liquidity they have and not loaning it out to people like people want to buy houses, which will then impact the housing markets. And generally that will put pressure on people on both sides of the Atlantic, because we're connected to the American system as much as they're connected to us, and on the backdrop of us trying to leave Europe, Europe is kind of just about to fragment behind us. You know, it's some of the largest countries in Europe are about to leave or form their own currencies again, and certainly they need to restructure their banks because the single market euro has damaged a lot of economies. For instance, the Italian economy has had real difficulty because it hasn't been able to be competitive for its exports because it's been pegged to the value of the euro, and so it's piled up mountains of debt, and their banks are continually having to be bailed out, and similarly Spanish banks. And as we even saw just before Christmas, you saw the state of the German banks. You know, we were actually within hours of the largest bank in Germany, a bank which actually carries 53% of all the debt in Germany. We were within hours of it potentially collapsing, and it was only a last minute rally, probably because it's being run by a Yorkshireman, that it was actually brought round and then sort of had some life
breathed back into it.
Yes, I think I'm breaking these teeth in for a donkey.
All right. So, give him a rest in a minute. I've got some more questions.
Okay, carry on.
All right, so there's been a lot of great chat in the chat room here. It's really getting everybody going. Here's the thing. Here's one of the things that I have learned from being involved in a network of barter systems that we created in the noughties. I started with this barter system here in about 98. I was a Microsoft Access programmer, and they were looking for somebody to automate their spreadsheet system into an Access system, and I was there, so that's what I did. And the system is still running. We still have a newsletter, we still got a core group. But one of the things that we always made sure is that we had a balanced system. So it was like leak-proof. But here's the thing. Here is the big thing. Various other groups tried it. And some clever clogs in the social services sector thought, wouldn't it be a good idea to give a group of men? I don't want to use the word. What do you call them? What's the right word for mentally handicapped? Anyway, mentally handicapped. But basically, people who are not, completely responsible for themselves, and they gave them a barter system, and you know what they did? It was fascinating. It was real fascinating stuff. Because you know how people who have mental issues are in what we call denial. They created a denial account and all their bad stuff they threw into it. And so this eventually this denial account outweighed everything else and the system collapsed. Isn't that funny? I mean, in this like bizarrely kind of ironically sad way, but basically, somebody in the chat room, let me just see what exactly they said.
Government and mine do the same thing. They call it the national debt.
Yes. Hasn't anybody figured out even the barter system doesn't work if you're dealing with delusional people? You know, that's completely true because, you know, as I said, I have dealt with delusional people and they break the barter system because they don't get it or part of the problem that they find themselves in manifested in this other system that they tried to create around. They manifested it into their environment. They poisoned their financial environment in that way. So that's a very interesting point. Are there any comments on that, Ben? Wynn?
Yes, that's why I'm designing this rather than anybody else. It has to be architected correctly. It has to be designed so that it almost has a social ethos of its own, and it's there by design. It's in the DNA of the system. So that, for instance, integrity, trust, morality are all factors that can actually be measured and used within the system, and the system can actually not only notarize but also measure, analyze and suggest values for things so that everything is held in balance within the total system.
And how do you know?
Well, that's the beauty of computers, and that's the beauty of having a system that's driven on a communication network. in that it can analyse node by node what the trade values of any commodity is on the planet, and it can suggest values, and it can see how your value deviates from it and see what the local variations are. It can find local areas to exploit the value where things are traded at higher or lower values. And so long as it's a system that's continually kept in balance, and that's the point of measuring all the commodity and measuring all the trades, is to keep the whole system in balance, then it's impossible for it to go anywhere other than be stable.
So what if there was a Bill Gates around there who would, like, buy this up and hack it and make him and his mates, you know, benefit from this whole thing?
And yeah, that's the big game. That's why not only is the system designed, but the way we design the system and the company is designed so that it is for everybody that operates, you know, within it. So I'm really there as almost a trustee, as a caretaker for the system. It's really a distributive cooperative system. So, first of all, the first system, which will be based in the UK, we're going to crowdsource fund the actual startup requirement for the company, and we want as many people as possible to own it. We don't want a small number of people putting a large amount of money, and we want an enormous amount of people putting a tiny amount of money in, because we want it to be as owned by as many people as possible, so as many people as possible benefit directly from profits that the system generates. We don't want some faceless corporation wading in and owning the company so that they profit hugely from everybody else, just like any other system. The point of this system is this isn't some faceless corporate system. This is a system that is for everybody. This is your system for you, run for you, and effectively owned by you. And for the people that actually contribute to the crowdsourcing campaign we're about to launch, then they will actually own it. So that is your Forrest Gump owning the Apple shares moment. And the more people that do that, the better. And we'd rather have 100,000 or 1 million or 10 million people owning putting a tiny amount in. First of all, because they're the people who understand it. So they're putting their energy in, their good energy, their goodwill into it. But also, it means that there aren't 5 or 10 or 100 people for some corporate to try and buy out. There are hundreds of thousands or millions of people, and you just can't do that.
Right, that's a very good thing. It's completely distributed. Mm-hmm. And owner-occupied, no, what's the word? not owner-occupied, but yeah, you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, the structure is, as Alex Collier would say, this is a holographic system.
Yeah.
That is, everybody that's part of it is a tiny part of the whole. And so this is not only an economic and architectural system, but it's also a social system that's holographic. And those are the ones that are truly reliable and truly resilient.
That's the thing. These systems build communities where there was none.
Absolutely. If you trade, you form social connections.
Absolutely. It's just like the old fashioned form of barter. You create clans. Listen, I've got one question, then we're going to take a break.
Okay.
And this is a question from Phil. Does the guest have any tips for short-term storage of money when taking from a bank, building society, etc.? I have a feeling that the under-the-mattress bank has somewhat of a risky being.
Yes, it is risky, and the problem is if you take money out from a bank in preparation for a bank not being there, it has no value. that's the problem. I mean, if you're going to take money out of the existing system, you can only put it into fixed assets, things that are useful to you, food, water, energy, you know, fuel, things that if you can imagine, it's like with renewable energy. If you want to imagine what it is that you require renewable energy to do, then turn off the main switch to your house and then walk around it working out what you need it now to do. And you'll soon identify that you need lighting, and then you need refrigeration, and then you need hot water. And you'll go through all those things. It's the same with money. If you just imagine what it is, if you work up tomorrow and the cash point machines didn't work and the banks had all closed, how do you get food? How do you get water? What do you need to survive? What do you need to keep your family safe and secure? What do you need to operate and trade normally? And that's your answer. Those are the things you should have.
Fabulous. So, now, everybody expects me to play Pink Floyd's Money. I'm not going to play Pink Floyd. I'm going to play Easy Stars, All Stars. And there we're back. Easy Star, All Stars with Money from the Dub Side of the Moon. Yes, indeed. Not what you expected, but, you know, this is Ever Beyond. We're going to drag you kicking and screaming into an alternate consciousness if it kills me. And I hope it doesn't kill me, but I tell you what does kill me is that daylight saving time thing. Apparently people do die because, like, people wake up and they get tired and everybody's stressed and they're late and they have accidents. You know, it's not a good idea. Ah, and it's a nightmare in these 2 weeks. But I'm going to tell you, Wolf Spirit Radio will be all over the place because, like, none of the hosts will know whether they're going to be on to, you know, in 1 hour or in 2 hours or in, or an hour ago. It's just going to be a nightmare. Anyway, having said all that, we're going to just push all that time away because time is money and we're going to create new money. And we're talking with Wynn Keach about how you create a new money system. And then basically you let the system down slowly so people don't realize it. And then there's no system at all. And we're just, everybody gets what they need when they need it. How does that really work? We're going to need some kind of electronic reproduction material, like the ultimate 3D printing thing, so we can get our stuff. How do we get our stuff if we don't, you know, if we just have barter and I've got eggs? How do I get my stuff? I like my stuff.
Well, people get stuff the same way we do now. It's because 80% of the population actually make all the stuff. The actual wealth that's in the capital system comes from 80% of the population. And that's work out. That's you and me going to work and doing things. There are mineral resources and natural resources. So you can grow things, harvest things, dig things out of the ground. And then there's manufacturing. So you take some equipment and you take the materials that somebody else has dug out of the ground or grown or whatever they do with it. And you make something else out of it. And then you pass that to somebody else who puts a hole in it and makes something else out of it. And eventually you end up with a brand new car and that sort of thing. So all the value of everything on the planet is actually made by 80% of the people. And then the wealth from it is then siphoned off by the other 20% because they pay you in a money that has debt. It is issued as debt. You know, it's, you think if you ever see a dollar, that it's worth a dollar. Well, no, actually it isn't. It's a dollar and some debt because the government bought that money on it with interest from the central bank that's issued it. And so even if you took all the money in a big heap that the government had ever collected to put into circulation and tried to pay off the national debt, you couldn't because you only have a fraction of the money because the debt on it is leveraged off it by a huge factor and at least a factor of 10 and sometimes a factor of 20. So, the money you have is designed to keep you as a debt slave. In fact, if you go into the history of money, which we're not talking about tonight, but if you go through the growth of history of money in the sort of 16th and 17th century, then you find that it's actually built on the back of slavery, and it was built and organized. You know, the banks were organized by people who actually had vested interests in slaves and the money to expand the banking system in the City of London, for instance, came from slavery. You know, from actual sale of slaves, the industries that slaves provided the resources from. So if it was, you know, if they were growing something or refining something or mining something, slaves that were doing all this. And, you know, the merchants and the banks, they were all cashing in on it. And quite staggeringly so. If you look in the 1700s in London, there's a fantastic study by University of Central London. They did a three-year study into the history of London and slavery. They found that at the time when slavery was abolished, it's a bit like the scrappage scheme we had on cars, where if you had an old car, the government would pay you for your old car, so you'd go out and buy a new one. Well, they did the same thing with slaves, or as they were then known, chattel slaves. And chattel means portable personal wealth. You were a slave at that time, were overtly controlled and directly owned by the person who bought you. And those are called chattel slaves. And chattel actually comes from a Norman and then derived old French word of cattel, which became cattle. And that is the basis of the word capital. Capital means head. It started out as heads of cattle. So you were, you know, if you're living in the capital city of London, you are a head count of the assets of the people who own this country, which in the country I'm sitting on is the Crown. You may have a freehold on a property, but you don't actually own it. The Crown owns the property. You have a freehold to that, which has restrictions based on it by the Crown, unless you have small principalities that you won in combat. That's called alludial property, which there's very, very little about. But, that's kind of the history of how it started in the 1700s. It's found that there were 2,000 people in central London that owned just over 50% of all the slaves in the world. And then 15% were owned by people in Scotland. And that was the machine that drove the economy and expanded the banking system and the economy of the UK at that time. And we went from that, the scrappage scheme, where you became freeman slaves, so you became debt slaves. So at that point, you were free to work on the plantation or in the mine or wherever it was you were, and you hadn't really anything to much opportunity to get away from it initially. So you had to pay a percentage of your effort and your income and your crop and everything you did to the people who previously owned you. I remember a quote from American slave traders and plantation owners. They said the only difference between chattel slaves and the abolition of slavery was that when they were chattel slaves, that we had to provide shelter and food for them. Now they have to provide their own food and shelter, which is what you do now. You do this on a global scale. The global economy is, in fact, that system, you know, the plantation slavery system, on a global scale. You just don't see the borders anymore. And the control of it is the money. The money is the debt. And the debt is the thing that shackles you to a life of working slavery. You're paying your efforts and your wealth to people who are doing nothing other than taking it off you. They're creating insecurity and wars to make you think that you need security, and they're causing economic instabilities to make you think that you need economic security, and actually you don't, because it's actually the 80% of the people that do the work that actually have control of it. They're just trying to exert control while you're too busy running around doing the 9 till 5, trying to pay the bills and pay to put food on the table for the children. So that's how the system is, I'm afraid. And interesting, we'll go to what happens when this sort of system suddenly stops. Because, you know, we could be facing that in the next 12 months. Certainly in the next 12 to 18 months, there is a probability that certainly regional banks could completely grind to a halt. And certainly some banks in some countries could, you know. Some of the Italian banks look very, very precarious. So you could wake up in certain countries in this world in the next 12 months, and your banks could stop. And then most people will be in shock because, as I say, we've been addicted to this system. So most people have limited ability to imagine what it's like beyond it. But if you lived in Ireland in the 1970s, you'd know exactly what that was. Fantastic example of what happens. Well, traditionally, if economies or currencies collapse, two things happen. First thing is people turn to barter trade, and the second thing is people invent a new currency. Funnily enough, Fairfax does both of those things. And in Ireland in the 1970s, there was a banker's strike. Okay, all the banks shut. All the bank staff decided that they wanted higher wages and better conditions, and so they were going to go on strike. And they figured that give it 3 days, and the whole country will be on its knees. So they duly went on strike, shut up all the banks, and Ireland just carried on. In fact, the Irish economy expanded. And the way it happened was because, you know, like in, you know, Yorkshire where I live, you know, in Ireland, you live in close-knit communities, small communities where everybody knows everybody. So you have integrity and trust, and you are known to people. It was interesting because, as you'll know from my old authentication security company, Swivel Secure, which is a global security company, the whole premise of Swivel was to be able to show who you are. That is, you know, be able to show your identity, prove your identity very simply and very conveniently. So people, if you know people, you have a relationship, you have trust. And, of course, FairX mirrors that globally. So you end up with millions of small communities that all know each other and trust each other, trading with other communities that the integrity and trust can be assessed by the system so that you can trade safely. In Ireland, when all the banks shut, what actually happened was people started just trading IOUs. So it's effectively barter trade. It's a, you know, promissory note made up by you, or an IOU note, in exchange for commodity. And so it went on, and the economy actually expanded. And being Ireland, the place that actually people exchanged these notes were pubs. So everybody went to the pub a couple of times a week. So the pubs became sort of clearing houses for IOUs. And IOUs were just people writing on bits of paper, backs of beer mats, backs of envelopes, anything to exchange between people they knew. You know, so I'll trade you my horse for however many bales of hay, or, you know, and I'll trade you my carrots for your potatoes, and I'll trade my milk for your eggs, and all that sort of thing. And interestingly, when it took 6 months before they restarted the banks, because what actually happens, the strike didn't go as well as they thought. 65,000 bank employees in Ireland moved to the City of London to try and get work, because the banks proved themselves to actually be redundant, and in fact a hindrance. And when they did restart the banks, they thought, well, you know, this is ridiculous. People, just anybody's just writing IOU for whatever. So there's bound to be a huge amount of losses because there will be a huge amount of fraud. There wasn't. Less than 1 in 1,000 of just any old bits of paper from person to person actually had any amount of fraud in it at all. So that's a better level of fraud than there is in the existing banking system.
Well, this is where we start, you see, because it's all fraud in the first place, isn't it?
Of course it's designed to be.
It goes back to
Babylonian times.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a shell, what do they call it? It's a Ponzi scheme. And when the Ponzi scheme is up, when they've managed to squeeze every last, you know, micro drop out of everybody, they step out of the game. And the idea of a Ponzi scheme is that somebody, you know, ends up being the fall guy.
Oh yeah, yeah. They do it through cycles as well.
Fleecing.
I mean, they orchestrate it because the thing is that they're in control of the finance, and they know the finance isn't actually got any value. It isn't actually worth anything. You know, you can't eat it, you can't touch it. It doesn't actually have any value other than the value you place upon it, you know, and its ability to exchange, because you believe that dollar is worth whatever, or that pound is worth whatever. So I'll exchange a big pile of these dollars for this car. Or it only has the value that you place upon it, because there is no commodity value behind it. And a lot of it is debt that's generated in a computer anyway. So when you have that kind of Ponzi scheme, and they go through cycles, they're like a pyramid selling scheme. They reach a point when people coming in the bottom that are bringing the real wealth into the system, when the system stops expanding to bring in more and more wealth, as people at the top and the top layers take the value out, then eventually it reaches the point where it becomes unstable and the whole system collapses. And that's why those schemes are illegal, unless you happen to be a government. Okay, so we go through periods of these fluctuations. So the system starts building up, and you start end up dragging in resource from across the whole planet, which you can see the United States has done certainly since the last war. The value is drawn out at the top. So, you know, it's drawn out as hard assets, usually property and, you know, fixed assets and that sort of thing. And then unfortunately it resets, and it's always the people at the bottom that lose the value. The people at the top who've taken the value out are the ones that go over the hill with a swag bag. And then they wait for the dust to settle and then restart it again. And that's really what the economy's engineered to do, because people are controlling these and have been controlling these for centuries. Then they go through these cycles, so that you go through a generation where you are somebody that's bringing wealth into the system. So you might be building your house, or you might be manufacturing something, or you might be growing your crops or whatever. And so you apply your effort and your skill and your knowledge to create some wealth. And usually the two biggest things that people own are either their car or their house. And the house is the most expensive thing, and it takes most people half their lifetime to pay for it. You know, for instance, I did the direct thing, and I spent 3 years of holidays, and I built my house, the one I'm sitting in now. So I didn't have that problem. So I've seen both sides of this coin. But say, for instance, you're a farmer, and so you borrow money to start your farm, and you start growing your crops, and you start building up the farm, and you start a family, and you start to expand, and you buy your equipment to make your farm better, and you just get it to that point, and then, oh dear, the economy's crashed again. And, you know, the banks have suddenly stopped lending, and they're calling in your loan, and they take your farm away. So you end up with nothing, or very little, and they end up with a hard asset, your farm. And because they control the markets, they know that they foreclosed on it. It hasn't cost them anything because the money they loaned you didn't exist in the first place, or only 10% of it existed. And so they hold on to the asset because they know that they're going to start lending at low interest rates again, and the market will expand in the next part of the cycle. So they just hang on to it and then sell it when the value goes back up again. And so they get the value out of it and they get the fixed assets. So they go through cycles of this. And we're at this point now. We're at the point of this bubble, and this is quite a big bubble. It's really a continuation of the 2008 market reset. It's kind of a boomerang that's coming back now. And it doesn't have the fail-safes to underpin it that we had before, because they've taken that part of the value out of the society. So there will be a fairly hard reset. It's inevitable. And when it does, people will lose hard assets unless they have control of their own wealth. And if they can find ways of financing things to achieve the same aims that don't require debt money, then that takes that out of their reach. So for instance, if you wanted to start a farm and you did it through Fairex, you could trade with people because you could get the things you need. So for instance, if you needed to lend the money from somebody within Fairex, you know, people could actually advance you the money in exchange for supplying crops or commodity, so you could actually buy the thing in the first place. Then you can trade the things that you grow. None of these points have you actually gone to a bank and had to use debt money that has interest on it. You can then, the resources that you would have had to go to the bank, for instance, you need a tractor. Well, you can get a tractor within Fairex. You just trade some of your crops for a tractor. Or you need people to work on the farm. You can trade, to get people to work on the farm. You can trade other things on the farm as part of their value. So you don't have to pay their salary just as a salary so they can go down the supermarket and buy the food. You can supply food from the farm or from neighbouring farms or people in the local community on Fairex. They can supply work. You can supply accommodation. There are all sorts of benefits and non-value trade assets that you can use that mean that you minimize the amount of cash you actually have to operate the system. And if you can do it all within something like Fairex, then if there is an organized banking cycle, then you hold your farm, you hold the value, you hold the wealth, and so you're immune from it, you're insulated. And that's ultimately how it needs to be done. It needs for people to have control on a global community scale of the wealth of the planet, because it's our wealth. It's our planet. We were born here. The people that are taking the wealth out of this are a tiny percentage of the population. You know, there's a staggering statistic. Something like half the world's wealth is owned by 6 people. Okay? Now, I don't know about you, but why would somebody need that much wealth? I need a minuscule amount of money to live on. All the things that are of value to me in my life don't have a monetary value. You know, friends, relationships, spirituality, health, you know, wisdom. These things don't have a monetary value.
Exactly. But when?
Yeah.
But when? It all comes down to those 6 people who own all this wealth. These are the reptilian overlords.
They are, and they're psychopaths.
And they are the insane part of this system that we've been saying is insane. But here's the thing, Wynn.
Mm-hmm.
Remember,
Hello. All
those millions of years ago, what this is all about.
I do remember that. I very, very much remember that.
Would you like to, I mean, as I was saying, you know, we've got half an hour left, right? So I want to tie this in because it's a bigger thing.
It's a much bigger, long way. And I'd like you to fill the audience in with what I'm alluding to as well. Would you like to provide that?
Yes.
I mean, there's loads of questions that's come up, but I think you've kind of answered most of the questions. You know, the thing, how do you trade carrots for shoes? But, you know, I've got too many carrots, but, so yeah, with that seed, if you could grow the bush and describe it to our audience.
Absolutely. Yes. I mean, what we've been talking about is really a blink of an eye local history. And, you know, we're talking last 6,000 years. This Babylonian system was brought here by the Anunnaki and enforced by the Anunnaki hybrids. And their descendants are the percentage of our population, which is less than 5%, that has more reptilian DNA, but also is the same 5% that tend to be hardwired psychopaths. So that's who's running everything. And this is just a local blip. If we go back 120 million years, the situation was different. And if we go forwards as well, JP, if we I saw a brilliant cartoon which indicates the direction we're headed in. Because not only do we need to know our history, but we need to know where we're headed. There was a brilliantly funny cartoon I saw. There's the boy talking to his father, and the boy says, "Dad, why is it when we watch Star Trek, there's no money on Star Trek?" And the father turns around and he says, "Because it's the future, son." So.
Always.
Yeah. Exactly. So now, if we go back 120 million years, there was a bit of a dust up in this solar system, to say the least. The fifth planet, Marduk, as it was known then, was completely destroyed and became our asteroid belt. I have past life memories of dying at that time. And quite interestingly, a lot of the souls of the people involved both in that attack and people that were reptilian who were destroyed in that attack are still around on this planet right now. Listening to this very show. And the reptilian ones are getting even more worried.
there's some people that are getting very itchy at this moment.
I would imagine that there are. Well, they're getting very itchy anyway. It's all the scales, you know. Yes, as you probably gathered, I was on the Pleiadian side of this thing. And the reason was that, well, there's many reasons, but apart from them being genocidal and psychopaths that had a colony on the fifth planet and to a lesser extent on Mars at the time, there was a big attack. And the Pleiadians had nearly been driven to the point of extinction. We'd been driven out of Lyra. As you know, we ended up in New Lyra. Pleiadians had to become warlike. Some parts of the Pleiadian society were captured and taken over by the reptilians. All sorts of bad things happened. But we were on the point of losing humanity. And it was the Empire Strikes Back. And it was a do-or-dare, desperate raid to knock out this outpost in this solar system, which is very strategic because we're the sort of last filling station to the next galaxy. So if they got beyond this point, they'd breach into the next galaxy and destroy an entire other galaxy's worth of good people. And it wasn't going to be allowed to happen. And the Pleiadians needed to knock out the infrastructure anyway. They wanted to stop reptilians spreading and the AI infection that they carried with them going any further. And there was a massive raid. Earth, as we see it now, was an entirely different planet. It was mostly forested, it was undeveloped, and it was in a different orbit to the one it's in now. It also had a different moon. And we attacked it. I was part of the attack on Mars. There were two ships attacked Mars, and that was part of, the two ships were actually like aircraft carriers, they're like a small fleet each. And they had things to do. They had to knock out the command and control structure on Mars, which was part of the defense grid for Maldek. And then three other ships attacked Maldek, and they drove three enormous atomic weapons into the crust of the planet and exploded it. And unfortunately, it didn't do too well for Mars. The debris field and the explosions that had to be used for the EMP pulse to knock out the AI system and the command and control system damaged the northern oceans and caused damage to the atmosphere. And then the orbital debris from Maldek soon came by and stole quite a bit of the atmosphere as well. And a lot of it ended up here on Earth.
I was also, I also am of the opinion that Mars was fracked. and that the atmosphere was volatile, and therefore when your EMP set off, it just set fire to the damn thing.
There was a miscalculation. It had a bigger impact than was designed. And I know when the first hydrogen bomb tests were carried out on Earth, they weren't sure whether the oceans were going to ignite or not. They did it anyway, which shows you the level of psychopathy that we're dealing with here. But nonetheless, it was amplified by something that was unexpected, and it caused more damage than was expected, but it had to be done anyway. And yes, a lot of souls suddenly left the third dimension, including my own. And a lot of them, were captured into the energetic field of this planet, Earth. This planet shifted its orbit. Interesting, you'd think that there's a huge karma with this, but having spoken to Simon Park's mum, he pointed out that there was a huge balancing of the karma, because, okay, the reptilians were very negative, but, you know, nonetheless, they're a life form, and it's bad to go around wiping out any life form. But they were causing a lot of damage to a lot of other life forms all over the place, including, you know, humanity. But the incident actually did another thing, which I didn't realise because I was dead at the time, which was when Maldek fragmented, because it was kind of a super Earth. It shifted the orbits of Mars and Earth, and they rebalanced as the point mass became spread out in a big circle, and so it changed the distance between Earth and the Sun, and it changed the gravitational constant, because the amount of energy from the Sun reaching the surface of the planet changed. If you're Mr. Newton, I'm afraid you're wrong. It's actually a wave.
And gravity doesn't suck.
Exactly. And that changed the orbit, and it caused an unprecedented growth and development and subsequent period of stability for growth for intelligent insect species, including the mantids, which eventually developed space flight, and some of them left for Cassiopeia. So quite interesting. Simon's mum said, look, you know, actually, I'm only here as an intelligent bipedal insect species because you lot blew up this planet. And if you hadn't, that reptilian lot would have killed us anyway, we wouldn't have developed. And if you hadn't shifted the orbits by destroying that planet, then we wouldn't have had the conditions to advance fast enough to get off the planet before anything nasty happened to it.
Okay, so thus, this was in the days when I believe the year had 260 rotations. There were 260 day years. I don't know how fast the rotation is, and so I don't know whether the year was actually the same length, but probably not if the orbit has changed. And this is, you know, cause I'm always just amazed at, the way people can look at something in such a literal way, that anything else from their point of view is just a fantasy or a myth. So for instance, you know, oh yes, well they had, the 260 days in this cycle. And, you know, and they would then explain away that, you know, the cycle didn't have anything to do with the length of the year. Mm-hmm. All right. What is the most obvious cycle? The cycle of the moon, the cycle mm-hmm. of the sun. That's the most obvious one. Mm-hmm. And the weather, when the sun is like this, the weather's like this. Oh, that's nice. Yeah, we can predict, you know, now we know when to plant the crops. So,
Anyway, get back to the timeline.
Meanwhile, back in this moment, we've just blown up Maldek, right? And there's water flying everywhere. Some of it is freezing to become comets. Mm-hmm. Some of it is solidifying and conglomerating, becoming asteroids. And other things are shooting about in all directions. So would you be saying that most other solar systems don't have this kind of crap going on?
Some do, some don't. The Lyran Wars have been spread out for a long time over most of the galaxy, but that's largely calmed down. We were an outpost, you know, we're the last filling station up the motorway, so it took a while to reach here. And also this was an area where there was some unprecedented developments going on with the humanoid species on this planet, because there was actually a re-evolving hominid species on the planet from 500 million years ago, which is part of our genetic makeup. It's the line that comes through the primates. That's another story. This is local history. So 120 million years ago, two enormous explosions on Mars, which you can see in the Northern Hemisphere by the Xenon 129 isotope measurements up there, and Maldek was blown to fragments. The reptilian outposts were lost. There were a small number of reptilians on this planet because this was really being used by the reptilians as a zoo, really. It was a DNA bank. Same way we have the seed bank in Carlsbad in northern Norway, but this was their DNA bank because they trade in genetic materials and basically in anything living. So there was a small contingent here. There were some troops from our side trying to wipe out the reptilians here. There was all that sort of thing was carrying on, and the whole thing restabilized. But there was the impact on the solar system was bigger than anticipated. And so this area became basically a no-go zone for some period of time while everything stabilized. And because of that, it also damaged the, what are effectively the motorways, the intergalactic motorways that passed by this section, which is why they were strategically important in the first place, they were damaged. And so it was difficult for the reptilians to resupply. And it was also more difficult for the Pleiadians to get here, and that sort of thing. So the area became largely left to its own devices for a while, until about a million years ago when other species opportunistically started coming in here. There was about 22 of them in total. And various things sprang up, various civilizations, Atlantis, Lemuria, all sorts of things. And we get to the very near timeline, in the last 6,000 years, you have a species of Anunnaki turning up, which are a reptilian species. And they hybridized, because they weren't adapted to this environment. They hybridized with the existing hominids here, which is Homo sapiens sapien. And you ended up with this kind of priest class of overlord, supervisor management kind of people, which are the Anunnaki. Okay, or your Anunnaki hybrids. And they're the ones that brought you Babylon. They're the ones that brought you slavery, religion, and politics. Or as I think of it, the unholy trinity. Okay. And the money system is part of that. And because they brought with them not only xenophobia, but they also brought with them the concept of slavery, because they're big into slavery. They like dominating, controlling, and enslaving people. So a big part of trade was slavery. And you look back at Babylonian law, for instance. Most civil law in the UK and in the Western world is actually based on Babylonian law. And in the Babylonian religious codes, for instance, the slave was not regarded or spoken of as a man, but as a thing, and is reckoned in the same way as cattle. Funnily enough, they referred to them as cattle then as well. Goyim, cattle, chattels, capital. And so that's what really went on. It was basically, if you're a very limited number of a species that is having difficulty living on here, that's had to hybridize itself to get any control, and you are cut off from resupply of technology, and you also wish to trade intergalactically, you have no option but to take what's there, i.e. humanity, and shape it to create the resources and infrastructure you want, so that on your long plan, which can be thousands of years, which in the scope of things, in 120 million years of activity, it's only a very short period of time, especially if your lifespan is thousands of years, then yes, if you're going to require integrated circuits and fiber optics and over-unity drive systems and all sorts of exotic materials that you need to extract from minerals on the planet, then that's what you do. You organize the civilization that you have a greater technology and knowledge than, so that you can control and manipulate it, and you get it to do your bidding. And if you can design it to be an open slave colony, all the better. And that's really what's been going on until, unfortunately, the entire population woke up after 2012, or a big percentage of it did. And part of it started to spiritually advance, it became evolved, awake, and there was a sudden drawing of the scales from the eyes, and people went, what the heck's going on this planet, and why are we doing this? And there has to be a better way, because this is just about as bad a way as you can possibly run the thing. And that's what's happening. And so people are spiritually awakening, religions are changing, politics are changing, And now the last thing to change is economy. And I'm part of that. And so I'm certainly here as a pathfinder to show the way and provide the tools to enable people to take the manacles off, take the handcuffs off and get actually to live in a free way and in a natural way, the way this planet was intended to. Because we are many and they are few. And there are so many good people on this planet that you only need a percentage of the good people on this planet to join together and do something positive to make positive change. And this planet will change in a very short period of time.
My guides told me years ago, and I've even put it on the website, galacticfreealliance.com, first the arrests, then the reevaluation of money, and then disclosure.
Yeah.
And disclosure has many stages. I can't even remember them offhand, so I'm just going to go and look them up, because it's just, galactic, oh, I got, yeah, there we go. Because disclosure is a different thing to what people, I believe. Because here's the five stages of first of all, we have to find out who we are. So who you are is the first stage of what we're going to be disclosed, with our origin. Who they are, which is what we've been talking about for the last 20 minutes. What they did. Again, ditto. Mm-hmm. What you can do is the fourth stage, and part five is the new beginning, where we actually do what we are able to do using the 5-second rule. We learned about the 5-second rule earlier. Have you heard about this?
No, I didn't.
Have a thought and count from, if you're feeling like, oh God, I don't want to get up, you do a countdown and it distracts your thinking mind from all the negative propaganda, and actually you just go and do it. So you say, well, I don't want to get up. Okay, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, boom, you're out of bed. And it's a way of bypassing the thinking mind, which just gets us into trouble. It's part of the part three. What they did is that they've had a controlling frequency grid that has been played on us. Mm-hmm. So that we are asleep, essentially. Yep. And this is what our benevolence, our friends up there who are waging a war above our heads as we speak. Because it's like, it's not quite over, but it's nearly over. And these troops, I'm jumping about a bit because there's so much to talk about, and maybe we should, what I'd like is a round table, and bring, because I've met a few people, right? I've met a pilot who says she brought me to this planet.
Mm-hmm.
There's a few others who have who write me letters saying, I've had these memories and I remember you. Then we had Audrey Ewis from New Lyra.
Ah, yes, yes.
Actually, describing in great and graphic detail what happened on Lyra. How it was awful. It was a real trauma. And he slept us through it. It was very uncomfortable. We had to know. They were talking about these, locust type beings that they send down that are like 6-foot locusts, that kill the people and just eat anything and devastate the place. So it's good. Mm-hmm. It's a scorched earth thing. A nice little reptilian trick. Anyhow, it's always good to know that there's a bunch of them on board every reptilian ship, so they could escape through into the ship. That would be a terrible thing, wouldn't it? All right, okay, so I've just taken up about 5-10 minutes. I feel I was among the group that was sent here to the planet. To like mop up. Yeah, it's going to be easy, right? You just find them, see them, boom, But obviously, being Pleiadian, things never quite work out that way. It didn't take long before I was deaded as well, but probably I reincarnated earlier because, I was here in the Earth's makeup. So yeah, 120 million years is a long time. to hang out in the void?
Well, only in the third dimension. We're actually multidimensional beings. And where our higher consciousness is in the fifth dimension, that's actually just happening now. So, yeah, it's all a matter of perspective, I think.
What? It's all happening now? What, we got to go through this whole thing again?
No. It's all in the fifth dimension, it's all happening simultaneously.
But on the third dimension,
you're in a linear timeline, and so consciousness goes a lot more slowly here, and so it's taken 120 million of your years. So it's different. Interesting what you were saying about the illusion, the false world. That was the Mayans referred to as HAL, which is also the name of the computer in 2001 Space Odyssey. They refer to that as the dream that's pulled over the eyes of humanity. And we're waking from that dream now. We're awakening, and I think we're going to go through a period of rebirth now. Obviously, the powers that have been for 6,000 years don't want to be pushed out of the way, and they're going to push all the buttons they can to try and cause as much chaos as possible so that people go running to them for a one-world currency and a one-world government. But I don't think it's going to happen. I think we're going back to sovereign states, and we're going to have our own currency. And I think we're just going to just put them in the box that says, you know, don't, you know, break glass in case of you want somebody to cause havoc again. I think that's how it's going to go.
So, let's just dive into the chat room. Keep in mind, let's do a special and explain the whole story of Maldek and the operation and the war and the whole, you know, the whole structure. I think that would be a fascinating presentation, like between two or three people from different perspectives.
And they love pyramid systems. They love pyramids of control, pyramids of money, pyramids of capital. It's all pyramids, and we're doing the opposite. We're going distributive, holographic with Therex.
Circles and spirals.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the way that the economy is enforced in terms of corporatocracy, it is an 80-15 5% split. So you have a very small number of off-world entities that are hiding behind the curtain, as it were. And then you have 5% of the population that are the descendants of the original hybrids that were put in place to run the thing. They're the ones that suffer from psychopathy. And it's interesting reading studies about self-organization of psychopaths and psychopaths in society. There's really only three places they can go because they are parasites. They don't actually create anything. They have no empathy for anybody by definition. And so they tend to form into clusters, and they end up in politics, banking, and religion. Funnily enough, all the usual suspects.
But, don't mention the reptilians. Don't talk about them over dinner. Isn't that interesting? Don't discuss the reptilians over dinner. Don't talk about politics, money, or what was the other one? Yeah.
I'm not sure the other ones. I talk about anything, mate.
Yeah.
So this is your 5% that's, you know.
You can invite Wynne round to dinner anytime. He'll come.
I will, yes. I love dinner. So that's the 5% that brought you slavery. They brought you all the above. But they're the ones that, you know, Mr. Trump is trying to drain out of the swamp now with, you know, with Pizzagate and all this paedophilia and worldwide satanic abuse and all this kind of thing. That's the 5% that brought you this. And because they realize they're not creative, they tend to be of a mindset that they don't actually get their hands dirty or want to do anything or actually have much skill in doing anything. They realize all they can do is cause chaos and manipulate people. So they identify the next section, which is the 15% that can be bribed or cajoled into doing their bidding or just, you know, plain deceived into believing that the 5% have power over them. And so those are the ones that they tend to put in places irrespective of capability within the large corporates. So those are the people running your banks, the people running the large corporations and the trans-global, you know, investments. Those are your people. So those are your 15% that are your upper management, because they're the ones that are just, you know, low-level sociopaths. So they're the ones that, you know, give the guy the whip and he will whip the guy beneath him in exchange for better food, rations and money. And those are the ones that unfortunately are less functional than the 80% that they're controlling because they don't realize that they have the weakness that's been identified by the 5% above them, the weakness to be bribed, the weakness to be cajoled or deceived into joining some
cult. Blackmailed by a paedophilia film.
Yeah, all this, or get into some kind of, you know, satanic cult that says, you know, you're being controlled by some, you know, satanic god. Well, it's not. It's just leftover reptilians I didn't kill last time I was here. You know, that's...
I know. It pisses you off, doesn't it?
So the 80% are the ones that actually have all the wealth, do everything, actually support the entire system. It just requires a percentage of the 80%, and it doesn't require many of them, to say, wait a minute, let's all get together, form a network where we trade with one another and support one another, and there's nothing the rest of them can do about it. Because you take your rattling toys home from them, because they require the deception and control from the 15%. To operate the 80% below. And when the 80%, as they are all waking up now, to the fact that people above them don't have their interests at heart, and that's the other thing. Because the normal person believes that somebody will treat them the way they would treat that other person if they were in their position, and they don't understand that somebody that's deficient in terms of their mentality isn't going to operate that way, then when people realise that, wait a minute, you know, these people don't know more than me. They don't actually know my job better. They don't know me better. They don't have my interests at heart. And we can all do this better directly anyway. Then it completely disempowers them. And this is what's happening. And you're seeing it on a global scale now. It's going across the planet. And you can also see that the 5% above them are panicking. They're in retreat. You know, they're scuttling off to the bolt holes in Antarctica and, you know, wherever they are. And they're throwing the 15% into the spotlight. They're saying, you've got your pitchfork and your torch. These are the people that you want to harass. Because, you know, they have alternative plans. And then these people are ending their usefulness to them. And then they're suddenly going to find out that, you know, the joke's on them. Because they were the ones that weren't as strong as the people beneath them. They're the ones that had the weaknesses that allowed them to be bribed and cajoled. So it's going to be interesting times ahead. We need to have control of our money, and I'm probably leading the charge for the whole planet on this right now, so we need as many people to get behind it, and this is what we're going to do.
Fabulous. People want you back to talk more about this. People want you back to talk more about Maldek. I want you back to talk more about everything. Well, you know, there are other things we can talk about as well, like solar powers and stuff like that. You know, really, we can get to a very technical point here, and a practical point. I mean, we've had one conversation quite a few months ago where we were talking about, you know, how installing a solar panel and what's the, you know, because you've been through it and because I'm going through it, we're getting to understand what it is and understand what the needs are. It's just like right at the beginning you were saying, you know, the house is basically a big UPS.
Yeah.
And understanding what a UPS is, an uninterruptible power supply, people, just in case you don't know what we're talking about. UPS is, it's not that horrible, courier place that breaks guitars, that snaps guitars' necks in half. Nothing to do with that, corporate disaster. But, anyway, so, it's a long story. It was a Kramer. They broke its neck. Anyway, long story. a long time ago. Oh, that hurt. It's still sore. Anyway, uninterruptible power supply is a little box. I've got one over here. So just in case the power goes out, it's got enough juice in it, in a battery, to last a few minutes, long enough for me to safely shut down and save all my projects. Say I'm editing a great big film or something like that. I don't want to lose that if the power goes. So it gives me a moment of grace. But basically, if you extend that, you can just run everything off that, off the same power supply, and scale it up. And that's what Win and I have been talking about. That, and that's how you power your home. And that's the home of the future is going to be like that.
And we're doing the same with money. Fairex is the same.
Exactly.
It starts as a short-term lifeboat in case of financial instability and a way for people to generate extra cash and wealth outside of the existing system. But you scale it and it becomes something you can run the whole planet on.
Because essentially money is really only about getting stuff and paying the man. You know, there's the man. He wants your tax, he wants your rent, he wants your this, you know. And essentially the man is not a man, it's the reptile. And we're now closing in towards the end of a 120 million year nightmare.
We are.
And that man, reptile, hybrid, Nazi, is not going to be there anymore.
Yeah, I think we've given them long enough to try and evolve, and they don't seem to want to.
And there's a wave of evolution that is coming that is going to sweep them away anyway. We're just about there. The whole thing is all converging at the same time. This is why it's so fascinating. And also why do they even try, knowing that they're not going to make it? Do they just think they're going to make it?
That's because of the mindset. It's about territoriality and control and survival. So that's the entirety that drives the reptilian psychopathy. So that's all they will do. That's all they're programmed to do.
Ugh. Chickens. I've learned a lot by living in this little house for 3 years with this little set of chickens. It's just fascinating I recorded Roger. I'm gonna put Roger. Roger is my rooster, but he's a little uncertain. So he's got like, he's got this funny little, at the end, which is like, oh, I didn't really mean to do it. And I see him and it's like, he's pecking away and I see his throat. I'm wasting time, but it's fascinating. It's brilliant to hear you. Always great to talk with you, Wynn. How do people get onto the, right, okay, so this is the time when you have to have a website ready for the talk that you've just been giving, because people will want to. How do I put in, look, why not have a campaign, a 10 buck campaign, 10 bucks to save the world. You put in 10 bucks, you get a share, and you can also start trading. Because, of course, if everybody who listens to this show, and there's going to be thousands of people listening to this show, if everybody listens to this show, just puts in 10 bucks, then we've got enough to kickstart the system.
Yeah.
How many people paying 10 bucks? I mean, you've got the numbers. What sort of numbers would that be?
Yeah, we need 50,000 people. We need £500,000 to get this through the first 4 months, and then it's self-funding.
Okay, well, if we can get, let's say, wouldn't it be nice if 5,000 people started from this and makes that a seed, and then that 5,000 people start trading and then bring their friends into it?
Oh, absolutely. This is how it will go. As word spreads, it'll get bigger and bigger. Well, what we're going to do initially, we're going to start the crowdsourcing campaign in around a fortnight, and the website will go live at the same time. In the meantime, anybody that wants to express interest, if they would email Simon Parks at simonparks.org, and then just put the subject FAIRX, that's F-A-I-R-X, then Simon will keep a database of that, and we'll make them aware as soon as the campaign goes live. And that would be an efficient way of doing that right now, because Simon is working alongside me with this, very much my right-hand man, very much my equal in this. And I do the technical, and Simon does the spiritual and the explaining better. So that's what we're going to be doing. And just an interesting statistic, working on minimum trade values and working out the nitty-gritty of people using this. If we manage to get 20 million people in the Western world to adopt FAIRX, then my part of the profit, which of course I put back into FAIRX, I don't want the profit, I'm just controlling it for everybody that's in FAIRX, wherever they want to direct it, whether it's to social projects, community projects, charity, renewable energy, it's entirely up to people. But that amount is enough to permanently end world poverty if we had 20 million people in this scheme. And that is my aim.
And a wonderful place to finish. So, going to simonparks.org, yes?
And simonparks.org,
yeah. Is there a link saying Wynn Keach's thing?
Simon says he'll put a link up, but if you just email him and just put the subject FAIRX, he'll make a database of it.
FAIRX at simonparks.org. Wynn Keach. It's been another one.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Brilliant. All right. Stay tuned for The World Healers. I'm amazed I'm awake. Oh, that must be the coffee. All right. Good night, everybody.